Kamehameha Schools Bishop Estate will know after next week who's in the running to take over harvesting a portion of its eucalyptus forest in the Hamakua area. Initially, there were said to be some 20 interested parties. We talked to the Big Island's asset manager, Marissa Harmon, about what happens once it decides who to award the short-term lease to.
We own 297,000 acres on Hawaii Island. That's approximately 82% of Kamehameha's land statewide. Our total statewide acreage is about 365,000 acres. In 1994, we acquired approximately 30,000 acres from the former Hamakua Sugar Company. And, there was a little bit of land prep time and planning, but between 1996 to probably the year 2000, the land underwent a planting schedule as well as being leased out for other uses like pasture. So of the 30,000 acres, we planted approximately 13,000 of those acres in eucalyptus.
And so tell us about eucalyptus trees, because folks might not be so familiar with it. I mean, I know it's fast-growing.
It is fast-growing. I'm personally not a forester, but I'll give you some basics of what I know. So our main species in this forest is Eucalyptus grandis. It was originally planted with the intention of being used for a paper product. So that was part of the selection for the species.
Okay, so now you've just gone out to bid, right, because you want to start harvesting some of these trees?
That's correct. Actually, the forest was previously under harvest. Our last tenant harvested about 2,800 acres of that forest. But in December of 2016, they notified us that they would not be seeking an extension of their lease. And subsequently, their lease expired on December 31st of 2016. So in early 2017, we went out with a request for qualifications, followed by a request for proposals to look for a new operator to harvest the remaining 10,000 acres. In 2017, we selected Pa'owilo-based Hawaii Forest, and we entered into lease negotiations with them. However, this summer, they notified us that they wanted to withdraw from the lease negotiation process. So after the negotiations fell through, we decided it was a good time to take a pause and take a deeper look at our long-term plans for Hamakua. You know, it had been a couple of decades since we acquired the property, so it was a good pause for us. Essentially, we're still very committed to the kuleana of our stewardship of these lands, and, you know, we're still excited about developing a post-era sugarcane industry in Hamakua. So we decided to move forward with the October 15th request for proposals that you likely saw in the newspaper. The RFP is basically to search for an operator to harvest that remaining, well, a portion of the 10,000 acres. This particular RFP is for 3,000 acres of that forest, focused in a couple different spots, in Hilo, Pa'owilo, Makai, and then an area near the rim of Waipio Valley. Long-term forestry will always be a part of our broader statewide portfolio. We definitely have a good chunk of our Hamakua land in active pasture as part of the cattle industry. We do have a couple of small farms on our Hamakua land as well, and some rural commercial properties, some residential rentals. So we have a variety of uses and activities going on our lands in Hamakua besides the forest. But definitely, you know, we, as lands transition out of being harvested, we are looking to other uses, as you mentioned, with our local community, with education programs, you know, going back to part of our core mission, really servicing educational needs of our community, and also reopening those lands for other diversified agricultural uses.
Can you talk specifically about what you might do for the community on the education piece?
Sure. I mean, we're actively working with community partners who are already running programs out on our land. We have one partner specifically in Pa'owilo. They're called Hui Mau, and they run a variety of educational programs on our lands, including restoring some cultural sites. And so specifically for that group, an expansion of their programs and in the expansion into actually growing crops as well on some of that former eucalyptus land.
And so what will happen to the eucalyptus then that is being harvested?
Well, that really depends on who the selected operator is. As we come out of this request for proposal process, it's going to really be up to the bidders to propose to us their use of the property and what they propose to do with the product.
I mean, as far as the mill and what the original use was for paper.
Well, you know, that original use was a prior agreement that a former manager had negotiated with a company in Japan. And so we no longer have that relationship in terms of that particular paper mill idea.
Okay. And I know we did have some inquiries from our listeners wondering about, you know, the burning of eucalyptus.
You know, we are not directly involved in that operation at all. So I think those questions are probably better directed at Huhonua or Honua Ola that is proposing that project.
Okay. And then what's your time frame? I don't know what kind of interest you've gotten on this this
sure.
latest RFP.
You know, if we did send out the request for proposals to at least 20 individuals that have expressed interest over the past year. I think since our news article went out, we also got additional inquiries to receive the RFP. Our time frame is fairly short. You know, the RFP went out on October 15th, and we have a deadline of November 15th for all responses. And it will take us some time to review those responses, sort through them. And so we're looking at the early part of 2019 in having that decision and rolling out to the next step. You know, we have our upper Malka watersheds that we continue to keep in native forest. We have Hamakua, which is more of like a timber plantation operation. We also have a koa project that we're working on actively planting out koa for future use and future generations. So we have a variety of forestry projects on the island and throughout the state.
And I know the Forestry Association is experimenting with Christmas trees. I don't know if that's any on any of your land.
It's not on our land, but our team is aware of the project.
Gosh, anything else? Anything else you think you'd want to emphasize just about, you know, the big picture, what you folks are doing with the properties there?
In general, we take our kuleana very seriously for these lands that Pauahi basically bestowed on us to care for and to keep for generations. And so it's not a kuleana that we take lightly, for sure. I mean, the decisions we make today, we understand they'll affect generations. And so, you know, our real premise is that Aina is pivotal in our Native Hawaiian identity, in the education of our people and community at large. You know, here at Kamehameha, we often say, you know, in terms of focus on land, I Hawaii nona Hawaii ka'aina. Hawaii is its land and resources. That's what makes us Hawaiian. And so we take that premise very seriously, that, you know, as long as our lands are taken care of, our people will be taken care of.
That was KSB's Marissa Harmon, asset manager for Hawaii Island, talking about the request for proposals due November 15th for parties interested in operating its eucalyptus tree farm along the Hamakua coast.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, real-life Golden Girls, senior citizens getting roommates to ease financial pressures and fight loneliness. We'll look at the growing co-housing trend for seniors across the country. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Oh, Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, a Hawaii-born steel guitar virtuoso who became a nationwide star in the early 20th century when Hawaiian music became a nationwide craze. His main instrument was the lap steel, but he was a guitar and ukulele virtuoso as well. One of his signature stunts was a version of Turkey in the Straw played with his feet. He honed his performing chops performing in the band led by his brother Joe, the Hawaiian Novelty Five. They had a regular gig on the Matsonia passenger liner that sailed between Honolulu and San Francisco and went on to a slot on the Orpheum Vaudeville Circuit North America tour. Now, the musician we're thinking about this morning built on his vaudeville exposure to launch a solo career that established him as one of the island's premier instrumentalists. We're looking for his name and the regal moniker that went with it. You think you know the answer? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag. It tells people you got it right.
Hi, aloha. I'm Jonah Pricing from the East-West Center's International Graduate Student Conference. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
A large piece of undeveloped land in Oahu's Ko'olau mountain range is now preserved in perpetuity for the public. The State Department of Land and Natural Resources acquired the property to be set aside for recreational activities like hiking and hunting. But accomplishing that took a lot of help and a lot of money. Hawaii Public Radio's Ryan Finnerty tells us more.
The Helomana Wilderness Recreation Area contains almost 3,000 acres of largely undeveloped land that will now be set aside for conservation. The state of Hawaii purchased the parcel from Dole Food Company for just over $15 million. Marigold Zoll spearheaded the acquisition effort for the State Department of Land and Natural Resources.
So in about 2013, I became aware that the land had been placed on the open market by Dole Foods. And we have a management right of entry with Dole to allow the public to go across their land to the Pomoho Forest Reserve. And it's a really important access point for recreation, for hiking, and for hunting. And when the land was put on the market, that would be a trigger to cancel that MOU and put the public's access at risk. And so I was concerned that we would lose our management access and the public access to the Pomoho Forest Reserve if it were sold to a third party.
To prevent that from happening, Marigold Zoll and the DLNR assembled a coalition of federal agencies and private organizations to fund the acquisition. The state of Hawaii only had to provide 1.5 of the more than $15 million needed to buy the land from Dole.
For example, the U.S. Forest Service provided funding for the acquisition with the idea that we would plant trees for forest products, that we would provide recreational opportunities to the public, et cetera. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wants to see us manage the habitat for bats. The Jimmy Robertson Fund wants us to provide hunting opportunities. And so with each funder, there are a set of obligations, and then we need to fulfill those obligations while also incorporating the community's desires. And I think that we'll be able to find a good balance on the landscape.
The U.S. Navy also contributed to the effort, providing more than $3 million from a fund set aside to prevent land use conflicts around military installations. Another major contributor was the Kaua'aloa Wind Farm on Oahu's North Shore. Kaua'aloa Wind was the third largest source of funding for the acquisition.
The Helomana acquisition specifically provides an opportunity for us to make our habitat conservation plan even better. And it's actually a fundamental component of our mitigation strategy. We view the Hillimano acquisition as a really great example of what can be accomplished for conservation when the public and private sectors work together.
That was Britta Wick, the Environmental Compliance Manager for Kōʻailoa Wind. Those wind turbines have been killing endangered Hawaiian hoary bats. As part of its permit, the wind farm is required to develop a habitat conservation plan to protect the bats. Helping to preserve the Hillimano Wilderness Area as a bat habitat helps Kōʻailoa Wind offset the losses around their turbines, sort of like carbon offset credits for industrial polluters.
The Habitat Conservation Plan is actually a requirement under the state's Endangered Species Regulations, and so it is a document that includes measures that the project is willing to commit to during project construction and operation. The plan outlines measures for avoiding and minimizing impacts to endangered species, as well as for mitigating those impacts, and also includes some mechanisms for adaptive management, so for continually sort of improving the way the project operates over time. We want to make our HCP as robust as possible, and as I mentioned, the Hillimano acquisition is really a fundamental part of that. One of the biggest challenges in environmental impact mitigation and for wind energy development in Hawaii specifically is developing measures that protect the Hawaiian hoary bat. It's a difficult effort because so little is known about the species. And so it was really a great alignment of things when the purchase of the Hillimano Wilderness came up as we were working on enhancing our habitat conservation plan. So one thing we know about this species is that one of its greatest threats is a lack of habitat protection. And so the Hillimano acquisition will expand protection of that habitat on Oahu. It is a means for offsetting impacts. So Kōʻailoa Wind contributed our $2.75 million piece towards the acquisition. And the acquisition really is going to protect that habitat in perpetuity. So it'll be beyond the lifespan of the wind farm itself.
The U.S. Forest Service paid the largest share of the price tag with $5 million. One of its mandates was to use a portion of the land to support the local timber industry.
That parcel has several positive factors. There's a large portion of that land that's agriculturally, it's in the agricultural district, so it has that land use designation. It was used for agriculture for many years, so it's relatively easy to plant trees.
That was Nicholas Koch, a forestry consultant on the Big Island and president of the Hawaii Forest Industry Association. He said that with Hawaii's ideal growing conditions, a crop of trees destined for a timber mill could be ready for harvest in as little as 15 years. Koch says that picking the right series of species to cultivate will be critical to make this a successful venture.
I would propose a suite of species that have proven to be successful in Hawaii. I would include tropical hardwoods of mahogany, Sweetenia macrophylla, which is a species native to Mexico and Central America, but commands a high value and has done very well all over Hawaii at that elevation. I'd also include the native koa, but of a particular cultivar or a particular seed source being developed by the Hawaii Agriculture Research Center that is more resistant to a fungal wilt disease. I'd stick to the ones that have a higher value and higher potential to be harvested.
The attraction of higher value species has to do with the market for wood grown in Hawaii, which is centered around premium hardwood products for luxury goods. Hawaii foresters don't produce much wood for construction.
At the moment, there's a limited market for that, mainly because the building specifications do not include species that are not southern yellow pine, which is a suite of species, or Doug fir. So really what we're talking about when we say Hawaii woods for Hawaii uses, we're talking about cabinetry, we're talking about things that are non-structural in a house. But that's still a significant molding and cabinetry and furniture is a significant use of wood. But by saying that, we're already targeting higher value woods that are prettier to look at. And I think that's important to keep that in mind when you're planting. A lot of things will grow on a piece of property. But thinking about the market first is, I think, important. That's what we've learned over the years here in Hawaii, is that we need to really think about where is this wood going to go rather than what grows on this property.
But above all else, the land will be used for members of the public to get outside and enjoy nature. current access to the Poamoho Ridge Summit hiking trail will remain open, and the DLNR will be conducting a public review process to hear what members of the public want done with the land. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And you can visit hawaiipublicradio.org to get more information on the new Helimano Wilderness Recreation Area, including maps and a breakdown of groups funding the purchase. You can also find that on our Instagram page, The Conversation HPR.
In HPR's Atherton studio on Thursday the 15th, it's Listening While Muslim, the B-side. This listening party will take you on a musical journey through an intersection of identity, politics, and culture. It's led by Shangri-La Curator of Programs, Asad Ali Jafri, and MC Naveed Najafi. Reserve your seat at hprtickets.org. Presented by Shangri-La Museum of Islamic Art, Culture, and Design in partnership with HPR Generation Listen.
It is now time for a reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Blaise Lovell joins us with a snapshot of early voting on this general election day. Good morning.
Morning, Catherine. Nice to be back on here.
Yeah, so I actually voted this morning. I didn't do early voting, and I know I was told by the pollsters there that they had a line waiting for them when they opened up at 7. So that was kind of encouraging at my precinct. You know, I know we always worry about the voter turnout. We have such a dismal record.
We do, Catherine, and glad to hear that your precinct there was a line. When I voted this morning, not so much of a line there at my precinct, but yeah, I mean, probably half of the voters that will vote in this election already voted as of Monday morning.
What were the numbers?
It was over 188,000, and that's just 1,000 less than what we had in last midterm in 2014. So the numbers are expected to go up just a little bit, so that might be good news. But also, our voter registration has jumped pretty significantly since 2014. State offices, there's about 756,000 registered voters now.
Now, I know on the mainland, it's a different snapshot. There's a tremendous turnout, but I don't know if we just don't have, you know, really sexy races this time around during the midterms.
That's right. You know, on the mainland, people are worried about healthcare issues. Immigration reform is a big topic for them, and these are some of the things driving a lot of young people we see to the polls in the mainland. But here, generally in Hawaii, we don't have many contested races, or if we do have contested races, it's pretty clear who the candidate will win already is. The preponderance of Democrats here in the state don't help any, and for a lot of people here, that kind of dissuades them from even showing up at the polls.
And talk about the early voting, because I know in your article you mentioned that a number of the registered voters, I think, asked for ballots to be sent out, but some of them got returned, right, because of bad addresses?
Right, there's a higher and higher number every year of more people requesting mail ballots, but I was on the phone with Honolulu, the Honolulu elections chief, and they do have some problems. Some people don't update their addresses. There could be typos in their names or their addresses, and that could lead to problems, and it could be why some people weren't getting their mail ballots. On Oahu, that meant about 3,000 people didn't receive those mail ballots.
Okay, and then as far as, a lot of the candidates, I know a lot of the folks running, you know, went down and cast their votes early for themselves, I would assume.
Right. I haven't seen any of the candidates myself, but what I will say is that you know, just because we're seeing more of these early voters turning out at early walk-in sites or via mail ballots, that might not necessarily mean that we'll see a higher turnout overall. Generally, the voters that have voted in the past will continue to vote, and it's really difficult to get new voters here in the state.
Right, and I know on the ballot we had the two controversial ones, the ConCon and the ConAm. We had the situation with the Supreme Court striking down the ConAm vote, you know, and so just the ConCon remains on the ballot question. And then there are also the charter amendments, too.
There are several charter amendments. Like you said, the ConAm question struck down by the Supreme Court. Depending on how much research voters do, that might determine whether or not they actually vote on it. Generally, what we have heard from analysts is that if people don't understand the question being posed to them, they probably will leave that section blank. And if, you know, those charter questions, blank votes are statistically basically no votes on them.
Right. And I know they vary from county to county. I think Maui's got the issue on the fines for vacation rentals. So, yeah, it's kind of a mixed bag on the ballot questions. Ours is with Hart. But all right, thanks so much, Blaze. We appreciate your story.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was reporting fellow Blaze Lovell with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org. After our discussion of the Hawaii Supreme Court's decision to void a proposal to fund public education with property taxes, John Ridgway wrote this on her Facebook page. Shouldn't we just go with the inevitable legalization of cannabis and use this to pay for our schools? I don't use it, but millions worldwide do. There is a huge market with little negative effects, far less than alcohol, or perhaps tax the visitor industry. We also have a couple of thoughts to share from our talkback line, starting with Joe from the Big Island.
I'm listening to the conversation on education, and they're talking about money. And I know how to improve the education system overnight. And tell every teacher, every lawyer, every doctor, every professional person to stop putting their money into private schools and send their kids to public school. You will see an overnight improvement in the school. Guaranteed.
Hello, my name is Susie Bond. I'm from the Puna District on the Big Island. Last night we were driving home from a concert in Waimea and noticed that the lanes on the road coming from Waimea to Hilo are so defined with the little sectors, and the white line even looks a lot brighter than any of the roads in Puna. And there's times driving back to Poa from Volcano at night where you cannot even see what the lane lines are. It would really be nice if somebody were to fix that and make the Puna side look as nice as the Hamakua side does. Mahalo.
And thanks for the feedback about our call-in show on the state of our roads and highways. If you'd like to share your thoughts as well, call 792-8217 or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Eating Up Easter, not the holiday, but the island. That's the title of a film about Rapa Nui. We talked to director Sergio Rapu about why he felt the need to make this documentary. The film explores the struggles of the Easter Island community as it tries to strike a balance with culture, the environment, and the economy. Rapu went to school here in Hawaii, but was actually born in Rapa Nui.
So when I was born on Rapa Nui, we had around 2,000 people that lived there. Today, there are probably about 10,000 people that live there, but we get over 100,000 tourists a year, probably close to 120,000 tourists. So the ratio is pretty big, and you know, this is on an island that is, you know, probably as far out into the Pacific as Hawaii is from California. It's a 5-hour flight. But we have one tiny runway, and you can drive across it in about 20 minutes. You know, we're slightly bigger than Kaho'olawe, but just slightly. So that impact of tourism is great economically, but it also has its downsides, right?
Now, we've done a number of shows here talking about this issue of over-tourism.
Tourism is an interesting thing because we need it to survive in this day and age. You know, in Rapa Nui, with the landmass that we are, we need to be connected to the rest of the world and involved in that industry and in that process. And we tried to make it very clear through our film that our film is not about stopping tourism coming to Rapa Nui. It's about us, the Rapa Nui people, consciously understanding what is coming in and deciding what to accept and what to maybe hold back on a little bit. And it really just, like, it's a story that also we feel like resonates with small towns across America, island communities across the Pacific and Atlantic. We are a global society, and we are buying and selling things all the time. Sometimes we don't really pay attention to what we do, right? So through the film, we hope to, one, promote sustainable tourism and sustainable tourism practices, but also to inspire this idea of how can we find local solutions to these much bigger global problems, trash, social issues, economic issues within our communities, things like that.
Talk about the title of the movie, of the film.
Eating Up Easter?
Yes.
Yeah. We started looking into this film with the question, I came across this article a while back talking about how much food is stored on Hawaii for a certain period of time. It kind of relates to food security, right? How much food do we need to import in order to feed our people versus how much can we make there? So I was like, I'm going to make a film about food sustainability in Rapa Nui. So Eating Up Easter worked. As we dug deeper into that question of how much food do we make, how much food do we need, I realized that the topic is not so much about food, but it's about development and demand. You know, what do we want as a local community? What do tourists want, demand as tourists traveling to, you know, this such remote place? And I realized with every cardboard box that we import that has food, the cardboard box remains and trash builds up. So it's really this idea of trash and waste and development is all interconnected, and food is just one aspect of it.
Do you address at all climate change?
We don't talk about climate change specifically, but we do talk about microplastics in the ocean. That's kind of a very physical, visceral example of how we are connected to the rest of the world. There have been some great articles that have been published recently about how, you know, climate change is affecting our communities, our island communities in Hawaii, just as it is in Rapa Nui and Fiji and all these other places. So it's very much a concern with my community in Rapa Nui.
Right, because if they're importing goods and the containers are left behind as garbage and then they break down, there you go, there's your microplastic on the beach.
Yeah. Our island, for an island that has no stoplights, we have a traffic problem because we buy and import so many cars to be able to rent them to the tourists. So yeah, granted, our carbon footprint is probably a lot smaller than an entire country, but we're all contributing to to climate change, really.
Right, and our trash problem. Talk about your experience here in Hawaii, because you went to school here, right?
I did, yeah. So I was born in Rapa Nui, and when I was about 8 years old, my family and I moved up to Oahu, and I went to school in Oahu. I graduated from Punahou in 2000, and I left the island to study film production and kind of build a career on the mainland. But, you know, my family still lives on Oahu. I'm sort of the black sheep who turned into a filmmaker and moved to the Midwest. They're still a bit confused about why I live in such a snowy place. But we travel back to Hawaii quite often. Our Polynesian Triangle is essentially Minnesota, Hawaii, and Rapa Nui. And for us, you know, Hawaii is this amazing intersection between the Pacific, Polynesia, and, you know, this behemoth, which is America, you know, the United States, not to mention in Asia on the other side. And in many ways, you know, we get a lot of inspiration from Hawaii, too, you know, trying to become carbon neutral, or at least pushing towards that, and all the very progressive functions that as a state Hawaii is doing. You know, I think Hawaii is really a great shining example for the rest of the Pacific.
So as an up-and-coming filmmaker, then, what's been the most challenging thing working on this documentary?
You know, I would say what's the most challenging has been, how do I make this relevant to other people? We set out to make a film not for the echo chamber. We didn't want to make a film that was just for the Rapa Nui or just for island communities. We wanted to make a film that would speak to a middle-income family in Wisconsin, or a group of immigrants that just moved to Europe, you know? Because really, I think the topics that we all deal with, whether you live in Hawaii or Rapa Nui or in these other places, they're very universal. You know, we, as a planet, cliche or not, we are a tiny island in the middle of this vast ocean. And I think once we start realizing that and sort of understanding that we are all really trying to solve the same problems, I think we'll be able to find solutions, at least for our own communities. Throughout this project, we continuously asked ourselves, why is this important? And ultimately, I think it helped to shape our film.
That was Sergio Rapu talking about his documentary that'll be included in the 38th Annual Hawaii International Film Festival presented by Hale Kulani, which opens this weekend. Here's an excerpt from the film.
My dad has held some big roles on Rapa Nui. He was the first native governor in 1986. Today, he's building the first mall on the island.
This is perhaps the largest construction we have today. And then in the space here, this is going to be the first elevator on this island. But that's all right, you have to bring something in. This mall was not thought for touristic purpose. It was thought to facilitate the life of the people in town.
Are there people that criticize this building for the idea that Rapa Nui is becoming not Rapa Nui?
Yes, I think in any very traditional community, once you bring new things in, there's always there's a certain degree of uncertainty whether it's good or it's bad. But after all, Easter Island is not isolated just like the past anymore. The island has to develop like any culture is changing.
That was an excerpt from the film Eating Up Easter. And an added bonus, hang on to your Eating Up Easter stub and get discounted admission to the Bishop Museum, where the newly opened Rapa Nui exhibit is on display until May 5th. In this morning's Backyard Quiz, we've told you about an island musician who was one of the stars of the nationwide Hawaiian music craze of the 1920s. Back in those days, songs like Hula Blues and the Aloha Waltz were among the most popular songs out there. You can find his collectible tunes on vintage 78s released under a variety of record labels, including Columbia, Victor, and Grey Gull, and under multiple names, including the Hawaiian Beachcombers and the Four Hawaiian Guitars. As the story goes, one night in 1935, while driving home from a performance, our mystery virtuoso was suddenly struck blind. No medical cause was ever identified, but his blindness didn't stop him from performing for two more decades or from completing a record-setting 22-mile swim from San Pedro, California to Santa Catalina Island in just over 22 hours. Now, in his heyday, he, along with childhood friend Saul Ho'opili, were the stars of the Hawaiian steel guitar. His name was King Bernie Navahi. Now, that was today's quiz. We got no winners, but if you have an idea for a backyard quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Anything Goes, it's a Cole Porter classic, but it may have been a way to describe the very early humble days of theater arts at Maui Seabury Hall. When David Ward first set foot on campus, little did he know it would become his life work. Now, looking back, he couldn't be prouder of the productions over the years and the community that embraced him. Take a listen as students of Seabury bring the 1930s musical to the stage.
And good's bad today, and black's white today, and day's night today, and the most guys today, the one bride today, are just silly gigolos. So though I'm not a great romancer, I know that I'm bound to answer when you propose. Anything goes. You say in your prayers you like, if green pears you like, if old chairs you like, if backstairs you like, if love affairs you like, with young bears you like, when nobody will oppose. So though I'm not a great romancer, I know that you propose. Anything goes. Anything goes.
We talked to director David Ward about how the program at Seabury has grown over 30 years.
When I first came on board, the arts were thriving at Seabury, but they were thriving in little pockets, like the English department would maybe produce a play, or, you know, these little things would go on. But there really was no cohesive department. There wasn't anything that really pulled everyone together. And the new headmaster at the time, Tom Overson, had a vision that the creative arts were really vital to the balanced education of the students at Seabury. So he had asked one of the English teachers to go out and recruit teachers that could form a complete performing arts department. And I just happened to be on Maui doing some work, some workshop stuff here at the time, and he approached me, and I thought, well, yeah, I'll do that. I'll spend a year or so here. So when we began, it was really meager. Like, I had 8 dance students twice a week. There was 1 drama teacher that was hired. We had a music teacher and a choral teacher. So there were 4 of us that we kind of began the department 30 years ago. You know, it's one of those things that sometimes in life, all of the stars line up and everything was just, it was the perfect time for everything just to come together magically. We were all very passionate people about what we did. We were all also professionals working in the business, not just as educators, but we were out there, you know, doing our stuff professionally. And we came together, we all worked for a couple years, and the department just multiplied and multiplied. I mean, the second year I went from 8 students to 20. 2 years later I had 40. Within 5 years I had 80 students in my program.
Wow.
And, you know, for a school of less than 400 kids, that's quite remarkable.
And now you're doing a classic musical from the 30s.
Well, yeah. I mean, we started doing musical theater in those first few years as well. But, you know, one of the big changes that happened was facility. You know, we were in a little dining room area on a small stage, maybe not more than 350, 400 square feet, and we would do anything that we needed to do to make shows happen there. And after a few years, the school did a capital fund campaign to build a beautiful new gymnasium. So we inherited the old gym, which was just this old metal-framed building, and it became our black box theater for 7 years. And we soon grew out of that. It seated about 150 people, and, you know, 7 years ago they built this magnificent new facility, state-of-the-art, sound, lighting, seats 350 people. And so now we are able to do these full-scale musicals like we never could have before. And yes, we're doing a classic musical from the 1930s, Cole Porter's Anything Goes.
So why did you decide to go with that one?
Well, I did Anything Goes. When we left doing our shows in the cafeteria and moved into our black box, we opened that theater with Anything Goes. That was 24 years ago. And it was one of our biggest successes, and it was a landmark year for us because we were finally getting our own theater. So it was a very, you know, it was a really motivating time for everybody in the department. And so as we're coming into our 30th anniversary, I thought, well, let's go back, let's do what we did, you know, let's repeat something that was really important to the progress of this program over 30 years. And that was what we came up with, because it was such a great show at the time. And I have to say, it's just a perfect vehicle for high school kids. You know, the music is so much fun. It teaches them a bit about history and the period of the 1930s in New York. And there's just nothing like Cole Porter songs. They're just infectious. You walk away, and you can't walk away without humming a tune, you know, after you've worked on the show for a few hours. I hear the kids gathering all of their stuff as they're walking out of the theater, and they're all humming a different song, but they're just stuck. They're imprinted in their brains. So it's magical. You know, the kids, their knowledge of musical theater is obviously more contemporary stuff. A lot of them have seen things like Lion King or, you know, just different things that have been touring or have come to Hawaii and that sort of stuff. And even, of course, now with the phenomenon of Hamilton, you know, that they know that show.
Yes.
They know every lyric in that show. I put it on, and I mean, every kid, you know, lights up, right? But I want them to have a sense of history. I mean, where did musical theater come from? And really, these classics, so many of these songs are in the American Songbook repertory, right? So they may be completely out of context from this show to the kids, but they have heard them before. You know, their parents have heard them. Some they've been covered by some singer somewhere along the generations, right? And so to see where this was all put together in terms of, you know, this show was originally done on Broadway in 1934, you know, starring the great Ethel Merman. So there's so much richness in the material, but it is important that we look at the educational part of this and what are we teaching our kids about America in that period, how different it was, what was pop culture. You know, today it may be hip hop and rap, but back then, Cole Porter was the edge, right? That was the pop culture of the day.
Right, and that music just makes you want to swoon.
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, I would never tire of this material.
Do you have a favorite song?
Well, gosh, I have to say from the show, probably one of my favorite is Blow Gabriel Blow. You know, it's a gospel style song. It's so much fun. The music is unbelievable. It just makes you want to get up and dance. And then, of course, the title song. I mean, Anything Goes. The lyrics in that are so clever and smart, and all the references to Garbo and Mae West, Jimmy Durante. I mean, you know, just people, just the stars of the day. It just really, really, you know, and of course, when I was growing up in my day, those were all those black and white movies that I used to stay up late with my family and watch. So it brings back some nostalgia for me as well.
Well, break a leg when you folks open.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
That was David Ward, who's been Seabury Hall's director of dance since 1988. The Makawa production of Cole Porter's Anything Goes opens this Saturday, the 10th, and runs for 2 weekends.
Do you hear that playing?
Yes, I hear that playing.
Do you know who's playing?
No, who is that playing?
Why, it's Gabriel, Gabriel playing. Gabriel, Gabriel saying, will you be ready to go when I blow my horn? I've been a scamp, but now
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we look at the election results and invite you to call in and join the conversation. Have you voted yet? You have until 6 tonight. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talk back line at 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of the conversation.